She's a depressed 20-something with a college degree, who copes with life by smoking too much weed, dodging cochinos as she rolls down the street.
Oye, mami, I wanna be your dog.
Aim higher, pendejo.
She's la marihuanera, as seen on IG.
That's me.
Marihuanera.
All right, marihuaneras, you are all in for a treat today. We have on the podcast a very, very, very impressive, interesting, fabulous guest, Jessica Gonzalez, attorney, cannabis advocate, Jersey girl, and recently made it onto the Times, or High Times, I should say, more impressive than Time, High Times 100 most influential people in the cannabis industry. Jessica Gonzalez, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. I want to ask you so many questions. I think what you do is so interesting, merging the law with cannabis and everything else that you do. So I want to start by asking how your relationship with cannabis started and then how you ended up practicing law and working in the cannabis space.
Sure. So I love this question. So the way that I started with cannabis, well, I've been a cannabis consumer since I was 17 years old. So I'm 31 right now. So we're going on a few years, more than a decade. And it was really a plant that just saved me in more ways than one. And I used to actually joke about becoming a cannabis attorney when I was in college and in law school. So to my listeners out there, manifestation is real, even with what you joke about. So I used to, you know, I was the one with weed. I was the one that could get the weed. I was the one that smelled like weed. There was always these notifications in the school about lockers smelling like weed. And it was pretty much always me. And so I always thought, though, that it was too impossible. It was a dream that didn't even seem like it could possibly be a reality. And so I just kept joking about it, and I never really thought it could become really a possibility. But when I started as a lawyer, I was started really in like labor and employment and intellectual property, mostly intellectual property in terms of trademarks and protecting like music companies, musicians, and working in the entertainment space. So from the outside looking in, you'd probably say like, wow, what a really sexy job for a first-year attorney. But sadly, it just wasn't what I had in mind for my career. And the way that I felt was I'd worked so hard. I had really sacrificed. My mother had sacrificed so much for me to be in this position as an attorney that I didn't want to waste it doing something that wasn't meaningful to me. So as life events would have it, I moved back to Jersey, and that was the same year, or it was the year right after, that the governor of New Jersey decided he was going to run on his campaign of weed and wages. And so I figured, if this man is going to assist with legalizing cannabis, and I'm in my first year being an attorney, perhaps there's an opportunity here to get involved in the cannabis industry through my legal work. And that's exactly how I got involved. I brought out my entire family and tios and tias and everybody to come out and vote for the governor, specifically because he was legalizing cannabis. And I just saw this as a way to be a leader in a space, because you wouldn't have lawyers, at least on the East Coast, saying, oh, hey, I got 10 years, 20 years of experience with this. Nobody could possibly say that.
This is amazing. So you were the marihuanera, and then you became the marihuanera, like mobilizing the people and advocating for change. That's incredible.
Yes, yes. It was, you know, it was an interesting journey, because when I first got involved in the cannabis space, I would consider myself an uninformed consumer. So I didn't really understand why it became illegal in the first place. I didn't really have any of that information or knowledge. And so when I started to get involved, I started to really look back at the history, really what happened. And I was shocked. I was shocked. I was disgusted. I was just completely appalled that we're still dealing with laws that were rooted in racism and discriminatory intent against Black, Latino, and Indigenous communities. And I started, you know, I sort of went from a really eager audience member to a panelist. And because I tend to be the only woman of color on these panels, all of the social equity questions kept coming to me. So I figured if I'm going to be in this position and if I can leverage the privileges that I have, the fact that I speak English, the fact that I have a law degree, and that I became a citizen of this country when I was 8 years old, that I should use my voice for those who may not be able to use their voice. So I began to really speak a lot on social equity and social justice. And I began to basically drive up and down the state of New Jersey to anybody who would listen to me for about 4 years as to why legalization was important for these communities that were disproportionately harmed. So I always tell folks, it's really all about figuring out what privileges, what strengths, what tools you have, and then transmuting them into something that's beneficial for the community.
100%. So, question, was your family a cannabis-friendly family? Were they shocked when they found out you smoked weed? Did you have to come out as a pothead? Like, what is that dynamic like?
Yes. Yeah, so I remember my first Instagram post where I was going to be posting about weed. And I remember sitting there in a cafe, and this was like late 2017, early 2018. And I was like, if I put this out there, everybody is going to know. And I sat there for like 30 minutes figuring out whether or not I should do this. But I figured if I'm going to get involved, I'm just going to have to go all the way. And what ended up happening was, sadly, I wasn't supported at my law firm for the cannabis work that I wanted to do. So I ended up having to leave that law firm and start my own law firm with another Latina lawyer. And so we were a Latina-owned law firm. And this was before legalization happened. So if you can just imagine what it was like to my entire family who had no idea about my cannabis use. Hey, by the way, I'm quitting my lofty law firm job to start a firm of my own in a space that is not legalized just yet. And that's when the family stopped asking about my career and nobody talked to me about it for about 6 months. It was very, don't ask them, don't ask me, I won't tell you anything. And then one day my mom said, Mija, can I ask you a question? Do you smoke weed? And I said, Mom, you know the saying, if you don't want the answer, don't ask the question. And she's like, okay, then I won't ask it anymore. But I was always the person at family events that was advocating for cannabis. So whether it's Thanksgiving, Christmas, whatever, my mom would actually before dinner have to take me inside and say, Mija, por favor, not today. And I would tell her, well, if they start talking smack about cannabis, well, I'm going to educate them. And eventually it sort of got to the point where everybody hopped on board of me being involved in cannabis when I professionalized it. And I think that was really important for my very immigrant family to see that I could possibly make a living out of this and actually be successful. And that this wasn't this drug that has really been, you know, out there and been perceived as dangerous, but it was just a plant that's just was demonized for political gain. And that's really how they hopped on board. But in the beginning, nobody was pleased.
And where is your family from, Jessica?
Yeah, so I'm from Ecuador. So I'm an immigrant of Ecuador. I was born over there. I came over to the United States when I was 3 and became a citizen when I was 8.
And, you know, I feel like our Latinx communities are so vast and so varied, and everybody has their own relationship with cannabis and reasons why culturally there is stigma or not. And as a Mexican American, obviously here in the American Southwest, and a lot of the criminalization and the laws that you've mentioned earlier in the episode have had that direct sort of impact on Mexicans and Mexican Americans. So that's my particular relationship, right? Like to cannabis. But for you and the Ecuadorian community and your family, what is that dynamic and that relationship like with cannabis? And why is there stigma or isn't there?
still very much a big stigma. You know, right now, Ecuador has legalized for medical, and there are some folks down there who are making moves, but there's still just a very, very large stigma about it. And even, you know, a few years ago, when I was explaining to my family about what I was entering, they were all just so concerned that I was going to get arrested, or they were concerned that this was going to lead to harder drugs because of, you know, the gateway theory that has now been dispelled. So the stigma is still very much alive and well. But I think, you know, what I tell folks is that if you can change your family's mind, you can change anybody's mind. And the only way to eradicate that is to just educate them on how this became illegal in the first place and inform them that this was not predicated on public safety or any sort of, you know, bad health effects of it. It all just had to do with disrupting communities of color. And once I began to explain to them that and show them the facts, it's when a lot of them really began to change their mind, because it was the US that really set that tone for the entire world. So I feel that it is our personal responsibility now to educate our parents, to educate our communities on this, because we now know better than they did. So it was a very, big educational crusade with my family that I think was a span of over 7 to 8 years.
This is so incredible. And I'm like kind of laughing because I can just imagine like you're with your family and you're so smart and accomplished and beautiful, and they're so proud of you, and you are so passionate about weed, you know, and like, and I can just imagine, you know, the conversations and the family dynamic, and because, you know, having experienced something not extremely dissimilar on my end. So I can appreciate you and your energy and like that you just kept at it until they, you know, like they got it. I love it.
And they're all on board now. And, you know, what's crazy is that, you know, one thing that I tried to do, you know, with my family is I didn't want to pressure them into trying it. Mm-hmm. So what I did was at a family event, I just left some infused cookies on the table with a post-it note that had a smiley face on it. And I just went around and whispered to my tias, like, you can go try it and I won't say anything to anybody. All of a sudden my aunts tried it. And one of my aunts, she's like, wait a second, this is not a drug. And she just kept saying, I understand the hippies now. Paz y amor. I understand paz y amor now. Love and peace. I get it. And they were so happy and they were just laughing, so much so that I literally became almost like the pariah of the family, who was sort of going off in this very, you know, rogue direction, to essentially becoming the family pharmacist. And now at family events, if I don't show up with some infused treats, they are mad. They are upset and they want a special delivery to them.
Oh my God, you totally converted them. I am obsessed with you. Literally doing the Lord's work. Like, this is what we need to be proselytizing. These are the conversions that need to be taking place. And I feel like it's so true. There's so many señoras that would benefit greatly from a little edible. So many señoras would have such a good night's sleep if they just had an edible.
And you have to give it to them in a way that isn't scary to them. Like, there's no way that I was ever going to be able to convince any of them to smoke a J or a blunt with me, but they're golosas and they really love treats and they love to have their cafecito at night. So I was like, let me give you something to help with that. And that's what it was like to them, to see it in a way that was non-threatening is what really got them on board.
I agree completely. It's got to be welcoming and it's got to be something that can be done in community, and it's fun and it's comforting. I am dying to do some events. I want to call them like Senora Stoner events, where it's like, bring your tia, bring your mom. Yes. Like, let's hang out together. Let's get high together. Let's talk about THC and CBD in Spanish, because I feel like that's a big part of it too. In general, right, there's still like not enough research and information about cannabis, because it's still like federally illegal, a Schedule I, like federally illegal drug, right? And so there's definitely not enough information in Spanish. So I'm curious too, for you, it seems like you're doing a lot of this educating in Spanish, and how we can bridge that gap with our Spanish-speaking communities.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting because while I'm conversational in Spanish, it does weigh on me a little bit to speak about policy and change and history in Spanish. So I've had to train myself on the history of cannabis and how I can explain it. But what I am doing actually is I'm literally studying Spanish so that I can be able to start talking to a lot of these communities and educating in Spanish. And my hope is that one day I'll be able to teach in Spanish. So I recently started as a professor at a community college here, and I will be starting as professor at a university at the graduate level next semester. And my hope is that perhaps, you know, in a few years, I'll be able to do the exact same education work, but in Spanish, because I completely agree with you that there isn't enough information out there for them. A lot of the events on the East Coast do have a lot of translators now, specifically because we do have a very big Latino population over here. But I agree with you that I don't think it's enough. And I do think that there needs to be these safe spaces created for these families to go, because if I just bring them to a regular networking event, they're just going to feel very overwhelmed. But if it's one where they see people who look like them, who came from where they came from, I think that might really, really help them sort of get on board and actually motivate them to get involved. Because, you know, I don't know about you, Mala, how you feel about this, but I do feel that Latinos are consistently left out of the cannabis conversation.
It's part of the reason why I wanted to start the podcast. I notice a lot of industry events. I notice a lot of brands, and I know that there are Latinos smoking weed, a lot of us. I also know that there are Latinx people working in the cannabis space, but it seems like kind of scattered. And I wanted a little central location where selfishly I could meet everybody and figure out what's going on and ask these questions. You know, this is all a ploy for me to what's happening on the East Coast. You know, let me talk to Jessica. And kind of wanting to connect the dots and give us a little bit of a central hub where we can chat and do events and hang out with each other and have smoke sessions and learn from each other and collaborate on projects. So I would say, yeah, definitely. I think that there can be more of us. And I think part of it is like what you're doing, starting our own. And I'm so fascinated by the way that cannabis and an Instagram post about cannabis seem to change your entire life, because you mentioned at the beginning of the episode that your law firm was not supportive. So you went and started your own law firm. So like, that is something that I'm also wanting to know more about from you is, yeah, starting our own thing when we notice something missing, and how that experience has been for you.
Yes, it was actually a very big learning experience for me to really go off and do that. Because the way that I saw it was, if I left that law firm, and I was still really in my first year or two, so just a baby attorney of how I was described, and I didn't see the job that I wanted out there. So I figured, well, I'm just going to create it. I'm going to really see how this goes. And having a law firm of my own has never been a dream of mine, but I did understand that I needed the freedom to work with the clients that I wanted to, the freedom to educate them how I wanted to, the freedom to testify the way that I wanted to at state or municipal hearings. And I just needed to not ask anybody for permission. That was my main thing, is I needed that autonomy. So I only really had my law firm for about a year before I was recruited to another law firm to build out their cannabis practice group. But what that 1 year gave me was just the ability to do as I see fit. And that's how I was able to learn. You know, I became my own IT person, my own marketing person, my own business development, my own billing person. So I learned a lot about businesses and starting a small business. So I was actually able to empathize a little bit more with the clients that I were taking on, because I work primarily with startup companies. So I could understand, you know, how hard it was even to get systems in place, to get processes in place. And especially in the cannabis space, you know, trying to do a startup for one of these cannabis licenses is so brutal and just very difficult and challenging. The fact that I had my own firm and I was able to do that, I was able to help a lot of smaller applicants, you know, smaller local folks who just weren't going to be able to afford a lot of these legal services. So I think what that 1 year gave me was a year of just not asking for permission and doing what I wanted to do. So it really got me out there. Right now I do work at another small law firm. It's really only about 8 folks, but the general autonomy that I experience, it's still there.
Incredible. You know, I can't even begin to imagine like what it takes to open up a law firm and just like the amount of knowledge that one needs to successfully be able to like, like have your own firm. That's very incredible. Congratulations to you. Super impressive. And it honestly gives me a lot of like comfort and hope. I'm like, okay, there are very legitimate minds and people like working in the cannabis space. Like it's going to be okay. You know, like things are being handled by like smart people. And I'm wondering like for you, I hear these things about the cannabis space and like professionalism, right? Like historically, because it's sort of been very black market and in and out of the mainstream, that sometimes in cannabis spaces, people don't treat them necessarily as workplaces or as professional places, and lines get crossed or boundaries get crossed, or, you know, behavior is not necessarily what it should be. And so as an attorney, I'm sure that you've like heard and seen and come across this in cannabis as well.
Absolutely. And you know, one thing is working in the cannabis space and then working in the legal industry, I work within two very white male dominated areas. And so, you know, even just lawyers across the country, less than 2% of attorneys are Latina, which is just an incredible least small number. So I was constantly, you know, mistaken for the administrative assistant, or the secretary or the intern. There were times where a lot of men, you know, really didn't want to shake my hand. I was written off very early in my career by a lot of lawyers who just thought, oh, you only have 1 or 2 years under you. Like, what's the point of even speaking to you? I really just had to create a different version of myself for this industry. And so actually sort of going back to Instagram and how it really helped change is one day I was like, you know what, if I want to be a cannabis attorney, like I got to say it with my chest. And so I changed my name to Cannabogada. And I did that because I felt that I needed to create somebody else, somebody who I wanted to be, somebody who I felt that, you know, I needed. And so I began to attend these events. I began to get louder. I began to get more confident. I educated myself immensely. I spoke with the community. I did so much free work for the community and education. And I think it really all went back to creating somebody that was different, because a lot of the attorneys that I saw were not doing the type of work that I was doing, and they weren't representing the communities that I was representing. And one of the communities that I really wanted to be involved with was the legacy market. I grew up with a lot of friends who were in the legacy market. A lot of my friends still are in the legacy market, and I have just an enormous, enormous amount of respect for them. And so the conversation becomes is, how do we get the legacy market to convert to the regulated market if they want to? And I think that caveat is really important, the if they want to, because I think there's this constant assumption that we need to get all legacy operators over to the regulated industry. And one, that's just never going to happen. That's just absolute. That's just impossible. It's not going to happen. But I think for the ones that want to do it, there should be pathways there for them. But I do think that there just are significant challenges in getting there.
And for our listeners at home who maybe are not familiar with this terminology, what is the legacy market? Who are these folks?
Yeah, so we refer to legacy market instead of saying the black market, instead of saying the legacy, instead of saying the illicit market. So some folks say the unregulated market, other folks say the traditional market, other folks say the underground market. I have just found that the term legacy market is a word that really does give the flowers to the folks who really set the foundation for this industry. I think if we're using the word illicit or we're using the word black, that it just has a lot of racial connotations to it that we definitely want to remove. So that's who I refer to when I talk about legacy.
A little cannabis vocabulary for our folks tuning in. This is what I love too about talking to somebody like you, Jessica, is, you know, I personally have already learned so much just in our short 20-minute conversation. And I know our listeners at home probably are going through something similar tuning into this episode. If people want to learn more, if they have questions, where can they find you? How can they find out more about the cannabis vocabulary and cannabis history and cannabis and the law?
Yeah. So the best place, at least until my website is up and running right now, it's my Instagram. So that's where I will post just current events that are happening, my general thoughts on shenanigans that happen in the cannabis space, events that I'm talking at. So that is Jess F as in Fox, G-O-N-Z. And right, I think that's my Instagram, or JF Gonzalez.
Fabulous. Jessica Gonzalez, attorney at law. And I am obsessed with you. I think you're amazing. I want to see a movie made about you and your life story. Because like, how cool.
One day.
Yes, girl. Let's collaborate on like a Senora Stoner event for the East Coast. I think that would be adorable.
I think it would be amazing. I would love to bring it, because, you know, I have been looking for events to bring out my family to, and I haven't found one just yet, one that would make them feel comfortable, because you know how they are. It's one event goes bad, they'll never attend another one. So you've got to make sure that there's one that they actually want to go to and that they feel comfortable with their people.
Oh yeah. And with cannabis, right? It's like, we got to find the right venue. We've got to make sure people, there's outdoor space so people can get air, and we got to have some food. And there's just all kinds of details. And I don't know what the landscape is like for events like that on the East Coast. Out here, even with things being the way they are in California, it can still be hard, you know, to do events like that, with consumption.
Yeah, definitely would probably be geared in the New York area. Since New York, you are allowed to publicly consume wherever you're allowed to publicly consume tobacco. That is not the case in New Jersey. Yeah. So if you're in New York and you want to walk down the street and blow some weed smoke in a police officer's face, like, you are more than welcome to do so. Not the case in Jersey, though.
Oh my God, this is amazing. Legally, you guys, she knows what she's talking about. So incredible. And that's a newish law that passed in New York, right? The consumption in public spaces.
Yes. Yeah. So that happened as part of what's called the MRTA, and that happened last year.
Incredible. It's, you know, things are changing here and there. It's very patchwork throughout the country, right? There seems to be no consistency to speak of. And I feel like that presents some interesting challenges. I guess we'll end with this. What advice do you have for marijuanetas out there who are wherever they're listening from throughout the country, and how they can make sure that they're safe when they're smoking, when they're traveling? What should they be looking into, you know, depending on their location?
Yeah, you definitely want to look up the consumption lounges in your location. Like, I remember that I was in Oregon and I was just walking down the street consuming, because I just assumed that, just given how progressive Oregon was, that I was technically allowed to consume on the street. And then I was informed that that in fact was not the case. So I would definitely say, look up your consumption lounges before consumption laws before you sort of get to another state as well. And then I also tell folks, I'm not a criminal defense attorney, but I really adhere and really support the script by the Pop Brothers at Law, which is just like, shut the fuck up, you know, if a police officer, you know, comes at you. And we actually had the case here in Jersey where a medical patient was pulled over and the police asked, you know, if he had anything in the car, and he disclosed that he had medical cannabis, and he was arrested and subsequently fired from his job. And this just happened like 2 weeks ago. And so, you know, if that were to have been the case anywhere else, the best course of action you can do is you just don't say a word. You're not obligated to. You know, if they ask you whether or not you have anything in the car, you just ask them, am I detained or am I free to go? And if they say, you know, you're free to go, then you go. If detained, you just invoke your Fifth Amendment. You don't say a word. And it's something that I've used since I was a teenager, throughout college, throughout my interactions with law enforcement. The less you say, the better. And then also to, you know, the marijuaneras who are out there who want to get involved, I think also in the cannabis industry in other states, I think the difference between the cannabis space and any other industry is that because it's so patchwork, it's imperative that you stay up to date with what's going on in multiple jurisdictions. And I know that for my job, it's really important because what's happening in California, for example, like we may not see that those same incidents for 2 or 3 years in Jersey. So I have to start preparing for what may come down the road. And the same thing for newly legalized states. So it's interesting that I have to know about what's happening in other states, even though I don't practice in other states.
There's like endless things that we could talk about with this because it's just, it is so patchwork. And so there's just like so many nuances and different case studies and things that we can get into. I would love to have you on again in the future. Maybe we can do like another check-in when there's more like interesting legal happenings in the cannabis space. But for this episode, I want to thank you, Jessica, once again, for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to come and chat with us on Marihuanera, a podcast for potheads. That concludes the interview. We did it.
Thank you, though. That was so fun.